For example, one plays a C on the piano and the F sharp above this. He might be so conscious of the C-ness of the C and the F sharpness of the F sharp that he fails to notice that they form a tritone, a dissonance which makes most people wince. Absolute pitch is not necessarily of much importance, even to musicians. Mozart had it, but Wagner and Schumann lacked it. But for anyone who has it, the loss of absolute pitch may be felt as a severe privation. This sense of loss was clearly brought out by one of my patients, Frank V., a composer who suffered brain damage from the rupture of an aneurysm of the anterior communicating artery. Frank was highly gifted musically, and had been musically trained since the age of 4. He had had absolute pitch as long as he could recall, but now, he said, it is gone, or it has certainly been eroded. Since absolute pitch was of advantage to him as a musician, he felt its erosion keenly. Originally, he said, he perceived pitches instantly, absolutely, as he perceived colors. No mental process was involved, no inference, no reference to other pitches or intervals or scales. This form of absolute pitch had vanished completely. It was, he said, as if he had become colorblind in this regard. But as he convalesced from his brain injury, he found that he still possessed reliable pitch memories of certain pieces and certain instruments, and he could use these reference points to infer other pitches, though this, in comparison to his instant absolute pitch, was a slower process. It was also, subjectively, entirely different, for previously, every note and every key had had a distinctive flavor for him, a character uniquely its own. Now, all of this was gone, and there was no longer any real difference for him between one key and another. Absolute pitch can shift with age, and this has often been a problem for older musicians. Mark Damaschek, a piano tuner, wrote to me about such a problem. When I was 4, my older sister discovered that I had perfect pitch, could instantly identify any note across the keyboard without looking. I've been surprised and disturbed to find that my perceived piano pitch has shifted upwards by perhaps 150 cents, a semitone and a half. Now, when I hear a recorded piece or a live performance, my best guess at what note is being played is consistently absurdly high. Damaschek relates that he cannot easily compensate for this, because I'm always so firmly convinced that the note I'm hearing is the one that I've always called by its correct name. It still sounds like an F, damn it, but it's an E flat. In general, as Patrick Barron, a musician and piano tuner, has written to me, older piano tuners tend to tune the highest treble octaves quite sharp, and the last 3 or 4 notes incredibly sharp, sometimes more than a semitone. Perhaps there is some sort of atrophy of the basilar membrane, or a stiffening of the hair cells which causes this, rather than a template shift. Other conditions may cause a temporary or permanent shift of absolute pitch, including strokes, head injuries, and brain infections. One correspondent told me that his absolute pitch shifted a semitone during an attack of multiple sclerosis and remained slightly off thereafter. It seems curious in a way that absolute pitch is so rare. It is estimated as occurring in less than 1 person in 10,000. Why don't all of us hear G sharpness as automatically as we see blue or smell a rose? The real question concerning absolute pitch, wrote Diana Deutsch et al. In 2004, is not why some people possess it, but rather why it is not universal. It is as though most people have a syndrome with respect to the labeling of pitches which is like color anomia, in which the patient can recognize colors and discriminate between them, but cannot associate them with verbal labels. Deutsch speaks here from personal experience as well, as she wrote to me in a recent letter. My realization that I had absolute pitch, and that this was unusual, came in the form of a great surprise when I discovered, at age 4, that other people had difficulty naming notes out of context. I still remember vividly my shock at discovering that when I played a note on the piano, others had to see what key was being struck in order to name it. To give you a sense of how strange a lack of absolute pitch appears to those of us who have it, take color naming as an analogy. Suppose you showed someone a red object and asked him to name the color, and suppose he answered, "I can recognize the color, and I can discriminate it from other colors, but I just can't name it." Then you juxtaposed a blue object and named its color, and he responded, "Okay, since the second color is blue, the first one must be red." I believe that most people would find this process rather bizarre. Yet from the perspective of someone with absolute pitch, this is precisely how most people name pitches. They evaluate the relationship between the pitch to be named and another pitch whose name they already know. When I hear a musical note and identify its pitch, much more happens than simply placing its pitch on a point or in a region along a continuum. Suppose I hear an F sharp sounded on the piano. I obtain a strong sense of familiarity for F sharpness, like the sense one gets when one recognizes a familiar face. The pitch is bundled in with other attributes of the note, its timbre, very importantly, its loudness, and so on. I believe that, at least for some people with absolute pitch, notes are perceived and remembered in a way that is far more concrete than for those who do not possess this faculty. Absolute pitch is of special interest because it exemplifies a whole other realm of perception, of qualia, something which most of us cannot even begin to imagine. Because it is an isolated ability with little inherent connection to musicality or anything else, and because it shows how genes and experience can interact in its production. It has long been clear, anecdotally, that absolute pitch is commoner in musicians than in the general public, and this has been confirmed by large-scale studies. Among musicians, absolute pitch is commoner in those who have had musical training from an early age. But the correlation does not always hold. Many gifted musicians fail to develop absolute pitch, despite intensive early training. It is commoner in certain families. But is this because of a genetic component, or because some families provide a richer musical environment? There is a striking association of absolute pitch with early blindness. Some studies estimate that about 50% of children born blind or blinded in infancy have absolute pitch. One of the most intriguing correlations occurs between absolute pitch and linguistic background. For the past few years, Diana Deutsch and her colleagues have studied such correlations in greater detail, and they observed in a 2006 paper that native speakers of Vietnamese and Mandarin show very precise absolute pitch in reading lists of words. Most of these subjects showed variation of a quarter tone or less. Deutsch et al. Have also showed very dramatic differences in the incidence of absolute pitch in two populations of first-year music students, one at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, and the other at the Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing. For students who had begun musical training between ages 4 and 5, they wrote, approximately 60% of the Chinese students met the criterion for absolute pitch, while only about 14% of the U.S. non-tone language speakers met the criterion. For those who had begun musical training at age 6 or 7, the numbers in both groups were correspondingly lower, about 55% and 6%. And for students who had begun musical training later still, at age 8 or 9, roughly 42% of the Chinese students met the criterion, while none of the U.S. non-tone language speakers did so. There were no differences between genders in either group. This striking discrepancy led Deutsch et al. To conjecture that, if given the opportunity, infants can acquire AP as a feature of speech, which can then carry over to music. For speakers of a non-tonal language, such as English, they felt, The acquisition of AP during music training is analogous to learning the tones of a second language. They observed that there was a critical period for the development of absolute pitch before the age of 8 or so, roughly the same age at which children find it much more difficult to learn the phonemes of another language, and thus to speak a second language with a native accent. Deutsch et al. Suggested, therefore, that all infants might have the potential for acquiring absolute pitch, which could perhaps be realized by enabling infants to associate pitches with verbal labels during the critical period for language acquisition. They did not exclude the possibility, nonetheless, that genetic differences might be important too. The neural correlates of absolute pitch have been illuminated by comparing the brains of musicians with and without absolute pitch using a refined form of structural brain imaging, MRI morphometry, and by functional imaging of the brain as subjects identify musical tones and intervals. A 1995 paper by Gottfried Schlaug and his colleagues showed that in musicians with absolute pitch, but not musicians without, there was an exaggerated asymmetry between the volumes of the right and left planum temporale, structures in the brain that are important for the perception of speech and music. Similar asymmetries in the size and activity of the planum temporale have been shown in other people with absolute pitch. Such asymmetries are not seen, interestingly, in blind subjects with absolute pitch, where there may be radical reorganizations of the brain, with parts of the visual cortex being recruited for the detection of pitch, as well as a variety of other auditory and tactile perceptions. Absolute pitch is not just a matter of pitch perception. People with absolute pitch must be able not only to perceive precise pitch differences, but to label them, to line them up with the notes or names of a musical scale. It is this ability which Frank V. lost with the frontal lobe damage caused by the rupture of his cerebral aneurysm. The additional cerebral mechanisms required to correlate pitch and label are in the frontal lobes, and this, too, can be seen in functional MRI studies. Thus, if someone with absolute pitch is asked to name tones or intervals, MRIs will show focal activation in certain associative areas of the frontal cortex. In those with relative pitch, this region is activated only when naming intervals. While such categorical labeling is learned by all people with absolute pitch, it is not clear that this excludes a prior categorical perception of pitch that is not dependent on association and learning. And the insistence of many with absolute pitch on the unique perceptual qualities of every pitch, its color or chroma, suggests that before the learning of categorical labels, there may be a purely perceptual categorization. Jenny Safran and Gregory Griepentrog at the University of Wisconsin compared 8-month-old infants to adults with and without musical training in a learning test of tone sequences. The infants, they found, relied much more heavily on absolute pitch cues, the adults on relative pitch cues. This suggested to them that absolute pitch may be universal and highly adaptive in infancy, but becomes maladaptive later and is therefore lost. Infants limited to grouping melodies by perfect pitches, they pointed out, would never discover that the songs they hear are the same when sung in different keys, or that words spoken at different fundamental frequencies are the same. In particular, they argued, the development of language necessitates the inhibition of absolute pitch, and only unusual conditions enable it to be retained. The acquisition of a tonal language may be one of the unusual conditions that lead to the retention and perhaps heightening of absolute pitch. Deutsch and her colleagues, in their 2006 paper, suggested that their work not only has implications for the issues of modularity in the processing of speech and music, but of the evolutionary origin of both. In particular, they see absolute pitch, whatever its subsequent vicissitudes, as having been crucial to the origins of both speech and music. In his book, The Singing Neanderthals, The Origins of Music, Language, Mind and Body, Stephen Mithen takes this idea further, suggesting that music and language have a common origin, and that a sort of combined proto-music come proto-language was characteristic of the Neanderthal mind. This sort of singing language of meanings, without individual words as we understand them, he calls hmm, for holistic, mimetic, musical, multimodal, and it depended, he speculates, on a conglomeration of isolated skills, including mimetic abilities and absolute pitch. With the development of a compositional language and syntactic rules, Mithen writes, allowing an infinite number of things to be said, in contrast to the limited number of phrases that hmm allowed, the brains of infants and children would have developed in a new fashion, one consequence of which would have been the loss of perfect pitch in the majority of individuals, and a diminution of musical abilities. We have little evidence as yet for this audacious hypothesis, but it is a tantalizing one. I was once told of an isolated valley somewhere in the Pacific where all the inhabitants have absolute pitch. I like to imagine that such a place is populated by an ancient tribe that has remained in the state of Mithen's Neanderthals, with a host of exquisite mimetic abilities, and communicating in a proto-language as musical as it is lexical. But I suspect that the valley of absolute pitch does not exist, except as a lovely Edenic metaphor, or perhaps some sort of collective memory of a more musical past. Chapter 10. Pitch Imperfect. Cochlear Amusia. Untune that string, and hark what discord follows. Shakespeare, Troilus and Cressida. Darwin saw the eye as a miracle of evolution. The ear, in its way, is just as complex and beautiful. The path taken by sound vibrations from their entrance into the external ear canals, through the eardrums on either side to the tiny bones, the ossicles of the middle ear, to the snail-shaped cochlea, was first worked out in the 17th century. It was suggested then that sounds were transmitted by the ear, becoming amplified in the cochlea, as in a musical instrument. A century later, it was discovered that the tapered shape of the cochlear spiral was differentially tuned to the range of audible frequencies, receptive to low sounds at its broad base, high sounds at its narrow apex. By 1700, it was realized that the cochlea was filled with fluid and lined with a membrane that was conceived as a series of vibrating strings, a resonator. In 1851, Alfonso Corti, an Italian physiologist, discovered the complex sensory structure that we now call the organ of Corti, lying on the basilar membrane of the cochlea and containing about 3,500 inner hair cells, the ultimate auditory receptors. A youthful ear can hear 10 octaves of sound, spanning a range from about 30 to 12,000 vibrations a second. The average ear can distinguish sounds a 17th of a tone apart. From top to bottom, we hear about 1,400 discriminable tones. Unlike the eye, the organ of Corti is well protected from accidental injury. It is lodged deep in the head, encased in the petrous bone, the densest in the body, and floats in fluid to absorb accidental vibrations. But protected as it is from gross injuries, the organ of Corti, with its delicate hair cells, is highly vulnerable in other ways. Vulnerable, as a start, to loud noise. Each ambulance siren or garbage truck will destroy a few hair cells, to say nothing of airplanes, rock concerts, blaring iPods, and the like. The hair cells are vulnerable, too, to the effects of age and hereditary cochlear deafness, and once the hair cells are destroyed, it has long been thought they are lost forever. Such problems can be expected to increase exponentially for people who play iPods or other music at too loud levels. It is said that more than 15% of young people now have significant hearing impairments. Listening to music in an already noisy environment, using it to drown out other noise, almost guarantees that it will be destroying hair cells. Jacob L., a distinguished composer in his late 60s, came to consult me in 2003. His problems had started, he said, about 3 months earlier. I hadn't been playing or composing much for a month, he said, and then I suddenly noticed the upper register of the piano I was playing was grossly out of tune, terribly sharp, detuned. In particular, these notes were sharpened, subjectively, by a quarter of a tone or so for the first octave, and a semitone or so for the next octave up. When Jacob complained of this, his host, the owner of the piano, was surprised, and said that his piano had just been tuned, and that everyone else had found it fine. Puzzled, Jacob returned home and tested his hearing on his electronic synthesizer, which is always exactly in tune. To his dismay, he found the same sharpening in the upper octaves here. He arranged to visit the audiologist he had been seeing for the last 6 or 7 years because of a hearing loss in the upper ranges. The audiologist was struck, as Jacob himself had been, by the correspondence between his hearing loss and his hearing distortion, both starting at around 2,000 hertz, nearly 3 octaves above middle C, and the fact that his left ear sharpened sound more than his right. The difference was almost a major third at the top of the piano keyboard. This sharpening, Jacob said, was not strictly linear. One note might be scarcely sharpened, while notes on either side of it would be markedly sharpened, and there were also variations from day to day. There was, in addition, one strange anomaly. The E natural, 10 notes above middle C, not in the hearing-impaired range, was flattened by almost a quarter tone, but no such flattening occurred with the notes to either side. While there was a certain consistency, a certain logic in the sharpening of notes in the affected range, Jacob was very struck by the isolated flattening of the E. It shows how sharply tuned the organ of Corti is, he said. A few hair cells out, the hair cells on either side in good shape, and you get one flattened note in the midst of normality, like one bad string on a piano. He was also conscious of what he called contextual correction, an odd phenomenon that made him wonder whether his problem was, in fact, located in his brain rather than his ears. If, say, there was only a flute or a piccolo above a bass, it sounded strikingly out of tune, but when there was orchestral richness, a continuum of tones and pitches, the distortion was scarcely noticeable. Why, if it was only a question of a few hair cells, should this correction occur? Was there something happening with him neurologically too? These distortions were very distressing to Jacob and disabling. He found it problematic, under the circumstances, to conduct his own music, for he would think some of the instruments were out of tune, or that the players were hitting the wrong notes when they were not. It was not as easy, either, to compose, which he tended to do at his piano. I suggested, half-seriously, that he get his piano or synthesizer mistuned to exactly the degree needed to counterbalance his perceptual distortions. This way, it would sound normal to him, even if it sounded out of tune to everybody else. Neither of us was quite certain of the logic of this, whether it would help him to compose or only exacerbate the problem. I also wondered if his hearing aids could be purposely mistuned, but he had already discussed this with his audiologist, who felt that the erratic and unpredictable character of his distortions would make any such effort impossible. While Jacob had managed very well when he had experienced only high-end hearing loss, stronger hearing aids had compensated for this, he had become worried when the distortions began, fearing that they might put an end to his conducting, to say nothing of undermining the pleasure of simply listening to music. But in the 3 months since the distortions had started, he had made some accommodations. For instance, he would work out high passages on the keyboard below the distorting range, then notate the music in the correct range. This allowed him to continue composing effectively. He could do this because his musical imagery and memory were intact. He knew how music, his own music and others, should sound. It was only his perception of music that was distorted. It was Jacob's ears, and not his brain, that had suffered damage. But what exactly was happening in Jacob's brain? People have compared the cochlea, the spiral organ, to a stringed instrument, differentially tuned to the frequency of notes. But such metaphors need to be extended to the brain as well, for it is here that the cochlea's output, all 8 or 10 octaves of audible sound, are mapped tonotopically onto the auditory cortex. Cortical mappings are dynamic and can change as circumstances alter. Many of us have experienced this, getting a new pair of glasses or a new hearing aid. At first, the new glasses or hearing aids seem intolerable, distorting. But within days or hours, our brain adapts to them, and we can make full use of our now optically or acoustically improved senses. It is similar with the brain's mapping of the body image, which adapts quite rapidly if there are changes in the sensory input or the use of the body. Thus, if a finger, for example, is immobilized or lost, its cortical representation will become smaller or disappear entirely, the representations of other parts of the hand expanding to fill its place. If, conversely, the finger is used a great deal, its cortical representation will enlarge, as happens with the braille reading index finger in a blind person, or the fingers of a string player's left hand. One might expect something similar to happen with the mapping of tones from a damaged cochlea. If high-frequency notes are no longer clearly transmitted, their cortical representations shrink, become narrow and compressed. But such changes are not fixed or static, and a rich and varied tonal input can serve to re-expand the representations, at least while the stimulus lasts, as Jacob had found out for himself. The power of context is equally clear in the visual sphere. The retina, like the cochlea, is mapped systematically on the cerebral cortex, and damage to it, or edema beneath it, can cause strange distortions of vision, sometimes a warping of horizontal and vertical lines, as if one is looking through a fisheye lens. These distortions may be very noticeable if one glances at individual objects. A rectangular picture frame may appear both curved and trapezoidal, or a cup or saucer bizarrely deformed. But these distortions diminish or disappear if one looks at a landscape or a rich visual scene, for context helps the cortex normalize its retinal mappings. In such a situation, some rectification may also be possible using other senses. A straight-edged windowsill, for example, may look wavy due to retinal deformation, but if one draws a finger slowly across the windowsill, the visual distortions disappear when the finger tells the brain that the edge is straight, but the distortions will then reappear behind the finger once it has passed. Visual concentration alone is much less effective. Seeing a triangle bulge in a non-Euclidean way, as if inscribed on a curved surface, one cannot force it, using knowledge or willpower, to reassume its proper shape. Bits of retinal image, it seems, cannot be retuned as easily as pitch distortions from a damaged cochlea. When we pay attention to, or focus on a sound, this, too, temporarily enlarges its cortical representation, and it becomes sharper and clearer, at least for a second or two. Could such a concentration or focus allow Jacob to correct his misperception of tones? He thought about this and said yes. When he was aware of distortions, he could indeed sometimes diminish them by an effort of will. The danger, he said, was that he might be unaware of them. He compared this sort of voluntary alteration to the way in which one might will oneself to see a particular aspect of a visual illusion, such as the face vase illusion. Was this explicable wholly in terms of the dynamic mapping of tones in the cortex and the ability to enlarge or shift these in relation to circumstances? Jacob felt his perception changing as he pulled the note in and as it escaped him once again. Could he actually be retuning his cochlea, if only for a second or two? What might seem a preposterous notion has gained support from recent work, demonstrating that there are massive efferent connections, the olivocochlear bundles, going from the brain to the cochlea and thence to the outer hair cells. The outer hair cells serve, among other things, to calibrate or tune the inner hair cells, and they have an exclusively efferent nerve supply. They do not transmit nerve impulses to the brain. They get orders from the brain. Thus, one has to see the brain and ear as forming a single functional system, a two-way system, with the ability not only to modify the representation of sounds in the cortex, but to modulate the output of the cochlea itself. The power of attention to pick out a tiny but significant sound in our environment, to home in on a single soft voice in the ambient din of a crowded restaurant, is very remarkable and seems to depend on this ability to modulate cochlear function as well as on purely cerebral mechanisms. The ability of the mind and brain to exercise efferent control over the cochlea can be heightened by training and musical activities, and is, as Christophe Michel et al. Have shown, particularly powerful in musicians. In Jacob's case, of course, this ability is constantly in training, as he has to confront and control his pitch distortions every day. Discovering that he had at least some voluntary control made Jacob feel less helpless, less the victim of an inexorable deterioration, and more hopeful. Could he hope for a longer-lasting improvement? Could his musician's brain, with its vivid and accurate memory of pitch, its exact and detailed knowledge of how things should sound, could this musical brain not compensate for and transcend the aberrations of a damaged cochlea? But a year later, he reported that his distortions were worse, more erratic. Some notes have a greater pitch shift, sometimes as much as a minor third or more. He said that if he played a note repeatedly, it might shift its pitch, but if it began off pitch, he could sometimes pull it in, at least for a while. He used the term audio illusion for the two notes, the true and the phantom or distorted one, and spoke of how they might interweave and alternate with each other, like a moiré pattern or the two aspects of an ambiguous figure. This shifting or alternation was much more obvious now that the tonal disparities had increased from a quarter tone to a full tone or more. The range of distortion, too, was creeping down. The two highest octaves, he said, are more and more useless to me. Jacob's cochlear function, it was clear, was still deteriorating, but he continued to play and compose in a lower register. "You work with the ears you have," he said wryly, "not the ears you want." Though Jacob was an affable man, it was nonetheless evident that the last year had been a difficult one. He had trouble rehearsing his own compositions, which he could not hear in reality as clearly as he heard them in his mind's ear. He could not listen to music in the higher ranges and experience it without distortions, though he could still enjoy Bach cello suites, for instance, which stay in a lower register. Overall, he was finding that music doesn't sound as delicious as it used to, and lacked the glorious, spacious resonance it once had. Jacob's father, also a musician, had become very deaf as he grew older. Would Jacob, finally, like Beethoven, be unable to hear any music at all, except in his own mind? One of Jacob's concerns on his first visit to me was that he had never met or heard of anyone else with a condition like this, nor, apparently, had any of the otologists or audiologists he had consulted. Surely, he thought, he could not be unique. This set us both thinking, wondering whether, in fact, pitch distortions might be relatively common in people with advancing hearing loss. Such changes might go unnoticed by a non-musician, and professional musicians might be loath to admit, publicly at least, that their hearing was off. In early 2004, Jacob sent me a clipping from the New York Times, "The Shushing of the Symphony" by James Osterreich, detailing the hearing problems in musicians caused by the ever-increasing decibel level of the modern orchestra. He highlighted an excerpt of this that had leapt off the page. "The problem of hearing loss, stemming both from the player's own instrument and from those of others, is a real one among classical musicians worldwide. Hearing loss may manifest itself as a decreased ability to perceive high frequencies or slight changes in pitch. But as pervasive as hearing loss may be, it's rarely discussed. Performers are reluctant to mention it, or any other work-related ailment, for fear of losing their standing in the field of their employability." "So there it is," Jacob concluded, "a confirmation of both pitch distortion as an adjunct symptom to the hearing loss and of our suspicion that the malady is usually a guarded secret. I will, of course, continue accepting and accommodating, just as I have for many months, but it's of considerable intellectual and psychological comfort to learn that as far as this particular malady is concerned, I'm indeed part of a large club, after all." I was moved by Jacob's philosophical attitude, his acceptance of the increasing loss of a power so crucial to his life and his art. I was intrigued, too, by his ability sometimes to rectify the pitches he heard, briefly, by attention or will, by a rich musical context, and, in more general terms, by musical activity. With these, he could fight against the distortions, using the brain's power and plasticity to compensate for his damaged cochleas, up to a certain point. But I was greatly surprised when, 3 years after his initial visit, Jacob sent me the following letter. "I want to share some wonderful news which I haven't disclosed to you sooner because I wanted to make sure it was really happening and wasn't a chimera or something temporary that would soon reverse itself. My condition has significantly improved to the point where on some days it is close to normal. Let me be more specific. I was hired a few months ago to write a score for a large string orchestra and several solo instruments, which largely called for semi-dissonant 12-tone techniques and the use of the full orchestral range. In short, the most difficult kind of music for me to compose with my cochlear emusia. But I just plunged ahead. I even capably conducted the recording sessions with my long-time music producer in the recording booth, checking for pitch problems, wrong notes, making sure the balance was correct, etc. During the sessions, I did have the expected problems accurately hearing some of the high passages, but when they sounded funny, I knew that my producer was hearing them correctly and checking everything. Anyway, the score came out wonderfully. To my disbelief, in the weeks immediately following all this, I started to notice, as I worked at the piano or synthesizer, that my emusia was ameliorating. Not consistently. Some days it was worse again, some days better, some tonal areas better than others, then a different set of anomalies the next day, or even next moment, but generally improving. Sometimes I would check it first thing in the morning, and it was almost normal at first, but within a few seconds it would jump back to the aberrant norm. But then I would try to correct it with an effort of will, and or by playing the same note an octave or two lower to help pull it back in to accuracy. And I found I could do this more and more often. This non-linear but generally improving process has continued now for almost 2 months. This improvement seemed to start happening right after I was composing, producing, conducting, and trying to hear, both in my inner and outer ears, harmonically and texturally complex music with an extremely wide tonal range. Perhaps it was like doing extensive musico-neurological calisthenics, and I was gradually strengthening whatever mechanism of will exists in the old grey matter that can be focused on this problem. It may be worth mentioning that during these last 4 or 5 months, I've been very busy with other musical projects as well. I first started noticing the distortions after and during a period of relatively little compositional activity, and now they have abated after a period of very intense and varied compositional activity. What Jacob discovered in himself has similarities to a phenomenon reported in experimental animals by Arnaud Noreña and Jos Egermont in 2005. They found that cats exposed to noise trauma and then raised for a few weeks in a quiet environment developed not only hearing loss, but distorted tonotopic maps in the primary auditory cortex. They would have complained of pitch distortion were they able to. If, however, the cats were exposed to an enriched acoustic environment for several weeks following exposure to noise trauma, their hearing loss was less severe, and distortions in their auditory cortical mapping did not occur. Jacob, of course, is overjoyed at this change, which promises to reopen a once-closing door, expanding his musical life and his enjoyment of music to the full again. And I, as a neurologist, am filled with wonder that the retuning in his musician's brain has been able to counterbalance the patchy and inconstant output from his aging cochleas, that through intensive musical activity, attention, and will, Jacob's brain has literally reshaped itself. Chapter 11. In Living Stereo. Why We Have Two Ears. In 1996, I began corresponding with a Norwegian physician, Dr. Jorgen Jorgensen, who had written to tell me that his appreciation of music had been altered suddenly and radically when he lost all hearing in the right ear after removal of an acoustic neuroma in the sensory nerve. The perception of the specific qualities of music, pitch, timbre, did not change, he wrote. However, my emotional reception of music was impaired. It was curiously flat and two-dimensional. Mahler's music, in particular, had once had a shattering effect on him, but when he went to a concert soon after his surgery and heard Mahler's Seventh Symphony, it sounded hopelessly flat and lifeless. After 6 months or more, he began to adapt to this. I gained a pseudo-stereo effect, which, although it cannot have been as it used to be, gave me ample compensation. The music was not stereo, but it was all the same broad and rich. So in the opening funeral march of Mahler's Fifth, after the trumpet announces the gloomy depth of a funeral procession, the full orchestra, fortissimo, I was almost lifted out of the chair. This may be my own psychological adjustment to the loss, Dr. Jorgensen added, but our brain is a wonderful instrument. Hearing fibers may have crossed in the corpus callosum to receive input from my functioning left ear. I also believe my left ear is better than should be expected from a 70-year-old. When we listen to music, as Daniel Levitin has written, we are actually perceiving multiple attributes or dimensions. Among these, he includes tone, pitch, timbre, loudness, tempo, rhythm, and contour, the overall shape, the up and down of melodies. One speaks of an amusia when the perception of some or all of these qualities is impaired, but Dr. Jorgensen was not amusic in this sense. His perception in the unaffected left ear was normal. Levitin goes on to speak of two other dimensions. Spatial location, he writes, is the perception of how distant the source is from us, in combination with how large a room or hall the music is in. It distinguishes the spaciousness of singing in a large concert hall from the sound of singing in your shower. And reverberation, he writes, has an underappreciated role in communicating emotion and creating an overall pleasing sound. It was precisely these qualities that Dr. Jorgensen missed when he lost the ability to hear in stereo. When he went to a concert, he found that it lacked spaciousness, voluminousness, richness, resonance, and this rendered the music flat and lifeless. I was struck here by the analogy to the experience of those who lose the use of one eye, and with this their ability to see depth stereoscopically. I have described such a case at length in my essay, Stereo Sue. The resonances of losing stereoscopy can be unexpectedly far-reaching, causing not only a problem in judging depth and distance, but a flattening of the whole visual world, a flattening that is both perceptual and emotional. People in this situation speak of feeling disconnected, of a difficulty in relating themselves not only spatially but emotionally to what they are seeing. The return of binocular vision, if this occurs, can thus give great pleasure and relief, as the world once again seems visually and emotionally rich. Yet even if there is no restoration of binocular vision, there may be a slow change, an adaptation analogous to what Dr. Jorgensen described, the development of a pseudo-stereo effect. It is important to emphasize the word pseudo-stereo. Genuine stereo perception, either visual or auditory, depends on the brain's ability to infer depth and distance, and such qualities as rotundity, spaciousness, and voluminousness from the disparities between what is transmitted by the two individual eyes or ears, a spatial disparity in the case of the eyes, a temporal disparity in the case of the ears. Tiny differences are involved here. Spatial disparities of a few arc seconds with vision or of microseconds with hearing. This allows some animals, especially nocturnal predators like owls, to construct a veritable sound map of the environment. We humans are not up to this standard, but we nevertheless use binaural disparities, no less than visual cues, for orienting ourselves, for judging or forming impressions of what lies around us. It is stereophony that allows concertgoers to enjoy the full complexity and acoustic splendor of an orchestra or a choir performing in a concert hall designed to make listening as rich, subtle, and three-dimensional as possible, an experience we try to recreate as best we can with two earphones or stereo speakers or surround sound. We tend to take our stereo world for granted, and it requires a mishap like Dr. Jorgensen's to bring home, starkly and suddenly, the huge but often overlooked importance of having two ears. No genuine stereo perception is possible if one has lost an eye or an ear. But, as Dr. Jorgensen observed, a remarkable degree of adjustment or adaptation can occur, and this depends on a variety of factors. One of these is the increased ability to make judgments using one eye or ear, a heightened use of monocular or monaural cues. Monocular cues include perspective, occlusion, and motion parallax, the shifting appearance of the visual world as we move through it, and monaural cues are perhaps analogous to these, though there are also special mechanisms peculiar to hearing. The diffusion of sound with distance can be perceived monaurally as well as binaurally, and the shape of the external ear, the pinna, provides valuable cues about both the direction and the asymmetries of sound reaching it. If one has lost stereoscopy or stereophony, one must, in effect, recalibrate one's environment, one's spatial world, and movement here is especially important. Even relatively small but very informative movements of the head. Edward O. Wilson describes in his autobiography, Naturalist, how he lost an eye in childhood, but nonetheless is able to judge distances and depths with great accuracy. When I met him, I was struck by a curious nodding of the head, and took this to be a habit or a tic. But he said it was nothing of the sort. It was a strategy designed to give his remaining eye alternating perspectives, such as normally the two eyes would receive, and this, he felt, combined with his memories of true stereopsis, could give him a sort of simulacrum of stereo vision. He said that he adopted these head movements after observing similar movements in animals, like birds and reptiles, for instance, whose visual fields have very little overlap. Dr. Jorgensen did not mention any comparable head movements in himself. They would not be too popular in a concert hall, but such movements might well help one construct a richer, more diverse soundscape. There are other cues that stem from the complex nature of sounds and the vicissitudes of sound waves as they bounce off objects and surfaces around one. Such reverberation can provide an enormous amount of information, even to a single ear. And this, as Daniel Levitin has remarked, has an essential role in communicating emotion and pleasure. It is for this reason that acoustical engineering is a major science and art. If a concert hall or lecture hall is badly designed, sounds may be killed, voices and music seem dead. Through centuries of experience, the builders of churches and auditoriums have become remarkably adept at making their buildings sing. Dr. Jorgensen says that he believes his good ear is better than should be expected from a 70-year-old. One's ear, one's cochlea, cannot improve as one gets older. But as Jacob L. clearly demonstrated, the brain itself can improve its ability to make use of whatever auditory information it has. This is the power of cerebral plasticity. Whether or not hearing fibers may have crossed in the corpus callosum to the other ear, as Jorgensen suggests, is questionable, but there most assuredly have been significant changes in his brain as he has adapted to life with one ear. New connections must have been made, new areas recruited, and a sufficiently subtle brain imaging technique might be able to demonstrate such changes. It seems probable, too, for vision and hearing normally complement each other and tend to compensate for each other if one is impaired, that Dr. Jorgensen, consciously or unconsciously, is using vision and visual data to map the position of instruments in the orchestra and the dimensions, spaciousness, and contours of the concert hall as a way of reinforcing a sense of auditory space. Perception is never purely in the present. It has to draw on experience of the past. This is why Gerald M. Edelman speaks of the remembered present. We all have detailed memories of how things have previously looked and sounded, and these memories are recalled and admixed with every new perception. Such perceptions must be especially powerful in a strongly musical person, a habitual concertgoer like Dr. Jorgensen, and imagery is surely recruited to complement one's perceptions, especially if perceptual input is limited. Every act of perception, Edelman writes, is to some degree an act of creation, and every act of memory is to some degree an act of imagination. In this way, the brain's experience and knowledge are called upon, as well as its adaptability and resilience. What is remarkable in Dr. Jorgensen's case, at least, is that after such a severe loss, with no possibility of function being restored in the ordinary sense, there has nonetheless been a significant reconstruction of function, so that much of what seemed irretrievably lost is now available to him again. Though it took some months, he has, against all expectation, been able to recover in large measure what was most important to him, the richness, the resonance, and the emotional power of music. Dr. Jorgensen's account was the first I had received of the effects of sudden deafness on one side, but since he wrote to me, I have found that his experience is far from unusual. One friend of mine, Howard Branston, related to me how, 20 years ago, he had an attack of sudden vertigo, followed by an almost complete loss of hearing in his right ear. "I could still hear sounds on that side," he said, "but could not unscramble words or distinguish tonal differences." He continued, "The following week I had concert tickets, but the musical performance sounded flat, lifeless, and without the harmonious quality I loved. Yes, I could recognize the music, but instead of the uplifting emotional experience I was anticipating, I became so depressed that tears came to my eyes." There were other problems, too. Howard was an avid hunter, and on his first deer hunting trip after his hearing loss, he found that his ability to locate sounds was severely undermined. "Standing absolutely still, I could hear the scurry of the chipmunk, the foraging of the squirrel, but the ability I formerly had to pinpoint the location of these sounds was now lost to me. I began to realize that if I wished to be a successful hunter, I would have to learn to compensate for the sensory handicap." After several months, Howard discovered many ways to compensate for his hearing loss on one side. He would alternate between analyzing a scene visually and auditorily, trying to meld the two perceptual inputs. After a while, he said, I no longer had to close my eyes if I kept scanning the scene by moving my head in a side-to-side motion, with a very slight up-and-down wave motion. After quite a while, I began to feel comfortable enough to go dangerous game hunting again. Now I was searching for sounds that were familiar to me. Composer, ethnomusicologist, and virtual reality pioneer Jaron Lanier is concerned with designing virtual reality with the greatest possible visual and auditory fidelity. He stresses that micro-movements of the head, movements of a few millimeters or tiny rotations, performed automatically and unconsciously in fractions of a second, occur even in those with perfect binaural hearing, and are indeed necessary for precise sound location. The scanning head movements that Branston describes, and which most of those who lose an eye or an ear develop, seem to be, at least in part, an amplification of these normally tiny micro-movements of the head. In a concert hall, Howard learned to turn his head slightly, as if I was looking at the instruments that would be playing at that moment, to the left for the violins, and slightly to the right for the bass and percussion. The sense of touch, as well as that of sight, was crucial in helping him reconstruct a sense of musical space. He experimented with his stereo subwoofer, which, he said, made me most aware of the tactile, physical nature of the sounds I was listening to. In his trophy room, which he had designed to be a perfect listening environment for his high-end stereo, he would use the power of the subwoofer to help him round up memories and images of sound and space. Perhaps all of us, unconsciously, use visual and tactile cues along with auditory ones to create the fullness of musical perception. With these, and doubtless many other accommodations, both conscious and unconscious, Howard now gets a pseudo-stereo effect, as Dr. Jorgensen does, and he enjoys music once again. Chapter 12. 2,000 Operas. Musical Savants. The first adult musical savant I met was a retarded man who had been admitted to a nursing home where I worked. I first described Martin in A Walking Grove, a chapter in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Martin had been normal at birth, but at the age of 3 he contracted meningitis, which caused seizures and a spastic weakness of his limbs and voice. It also affected his intelligence and personality, so that he became impulsive, odd, and unable to keep up with his classmates at school. But along with these problems, he developed curious powers. He became fascinated by music, would listen to it intently, and would then sing the melodies he had heard or play them on the piano, as best he could with his spastic limbs and voice. He was greatly encouraged in this by his father, who was a professional opera singer. Along with his musical abilities, Martin also developed a prodigious rote memory. Once he was fitted with glasses for the very severe visual problems he had been born with, he became an avid reader, retaining, though often not understanding, everything he read. And this, like his musical memory, was auditory. Whatever he read, he heard in his mind's ear, sometimes in his father's voice. As some people may be said to have a photographic memory, Martin had a phonographic one. Though solitary in his habits, Martin was able to live independently and to do simple, unskilled work. His only pleasure, seemingly, was to sing in church choirs. He could not be a solo singer with his hoarse, spastic voice, but by the time he was 61, his increasing physical disabilities, arthritis and heart disease among them, brought him to the nursing home. When I met him in 1984, he told me that he knew more than 2,000 operas, as well as The Messiah, The Christmas Oratorio, and all of Bach's cantatas. I brought along scores of some of these, and tested him as best I could. I found I was unable to fault him. And it was not just the melodies that he remembered. He had learned, from listening to performances, what every instrument played, what every voice sang. When I played him a piece by Debussy that he had never heard, he was able to repeat it almost flawlessly on the piano. He then transposed it into different keys and extemporized on it a little, in a Debussyan way. He could grasp the rules and the conventions of any music he heard, even if it was unfamiliar or not to his taste. This was musicianship of a high order in a man who was otherwise so mentally impoverished. What was the origin of Martin's musical powers? He had an intensely musical father, and musical ability is often inherited, as with the 7 generations of the Bach family. He was born into and grew up in a musical household. Was this enough? Or did his auditory and potentially